In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Rob and I will be talking about reasons why people won't buy your product and how to fix them. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 246. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products. Whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it, I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How you doing this week, Rob?
I'm doing pretty good. I'm ramping up for a bunch of webinars. I'm doing a webinar with Lead Pages this week, following up on the contest that I did a few weeks ago, giving away some Lead Pages for Drip. And then we're ramping up a couple Drip webinars. There's an educational one and then one that's more further down the funnel for people who are already using Drip or more curious about how it actually works. And so this is the fun part, right? This is where, as creative people, we get to kind of dive into outlines of things and figuring out what we're going to say. And it's kind of like writing a talk, but it's a lot shorter and you're going to be doing it online. So it's also fun to look at the whole funnel and figure out where we need a little few emails here and a couple mini courses here and how to integrate Drip with whatever we're going to use for the webinars and all this kind of stuff. So it's exciting. I like launching new experiments like this.
The nice thing about doing those kinds of things is that you don't have to get it right on the first time, because it's not like a talk where you go out there, you give the talk, and essentially it's over with, and you might or might not be able to reuse it. But with like a webinar, you tend to do those repeatedly so you can iterate on them over time and find out more information about what worked and what didn't. And that's what I really like about those things, is just the reusability of it and the fact that it doesn't need to be perfect the first time. And even if you completely screw it up, you can always try it again the next week.
Yep. I totally agree. And the webinars I've done so far have been kind of third-party things. Drip hasn't put on our own webinars yet, but I've still had a really good time just interacting with the people on the calls, and the questions that come out of it are intelligent and challenging. And so it's been fun. I mean, it's kind of, you know, when we go to MicroConf, when you speak at a conference, it's always kind of exhilarating to do it. You get a little nervous, and then you deliver, and then you have the Q&A part. And it winds up being really fun in the end. And that's kind of how webinars have been for me so far.
Very cool. Well, I've been trying to adjust to the kids' schedule while they're home for the summer. And it's proving to be a bit of a challenge, because my wife, she owns her own fitness studio, so she does some personal training and she has some group exercise classes. And because the kids are home for the summer and there are certain weeks where they are at different activities, whether it's art camp or karate camp, some of those things are all day affairs and some of them are not. So sometimes they're home for half the day, sometimes they're home the entire day. And going back and forth between my wife and I, trying to figure out, okay, who's watching the kids, who's going to be able to do work, we actually kind of broke down. And earlier today, we had somebody come over and watch the kids for a little while. There's another family who lives in the area. And we hired somebody to come watch not only our kids, but their kids at the same time, because their parents, they both work from home as well sometimes. So when the kids are both home, and they've got three kids, so when the kids are home, you're just not getting nearly as much work done. So hopefully that issue will resolve itself sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I never try to work with the kids at home. That's catastrophic. I get too frustrated. And I guess I should say, I never try to work with the kids at home when I'm watching them. Like, we have a nanny essentially that watches the kids a couple hours a day and also picks them up from camp, because a lot of my five-year-old's in a camp that ends at noon every day. And so she picks them up and then watches them for a few hours, then picks our older son up at four, and it allows me to have a full work day. So that's a no-brainer, man. I think you've made the right choice. I think if you're listening to this and you find yourself in this situation, go back and listen to Zen Founder episode 1, because Sherry and I delve into this and talk about our Sunday huddle approach, how we hire people to kind of drive our kids around. You know, it's essentially a nanny, but hard time is not necessarily the best quality time. And so we try not to drive all over town picking kids up. Rather, we try to spend time when we can with them in the afternoons and the evenings. So what are we talking about today?
Well, today's topic comes from Niles. I met Niles over at MicroConf Europe last year, and he says, "Hi guys, I just came across this post and thought it would make a great topic for the show." And I went over, I read the post, and it was over on inbound.org, and it was a post called 9 Reasons I Won't Buy Your SaaS Tool. And I read through the article, it was interesting, but I also felt like it came from the perspective of somebody who doesn't make the decisions about it based as if they were the business owner. It was more like personalized objections to it than anything else. I just felt like there was a different take that we could take on this article and use it to come up with our own ideas about what sorts of objections people have about different products and why they wouldn't come through and actually do a purchase, whether it's going from a trial to actually purchasing it as a SaaS product, or just if you have a book or something like that, and if you're selling it and it's a one-time purchase, just buying that, whether it's downloadable software or book, et cetera. But I think that there's a lot of different objections that people have, and what I wanted to do was go through a list of what those objections are and then kind of highlight how you would go about overcoming some of those different objections. So to kick us off, the first reason why a prospect wouldn't buy your product is that they don't understand what it is that you're offering. So in this case, they come to your website and they are looking at your product offering and they don't really understand what it does or how it works or what it does for them. And sometimes this is just a problem with the marketing messaging itself. If you're not real clear about what the value is that they get out of it, if you're talking more about the features and the functionality than it is about what they get out of it, the results that they're going to get, those are places where they're not going to understand what it is that you're offering and what the benefits are that they're going to get from it.
It's easy to err on two sides of this coin and go too far to an extreme. And if you go too much into the features too quickly, then people don't understand the real value they're getting out of it. And if you go too much into the value they're going to get out of it and the benefits, then it can actually be hard to figure out what your tool actually does. So imagine if we had a social media tool like Hootsuite, right on the homepage, you could say, these are the features that it has, and just start listing them down. And people are going to have a tough time absorbing all that information without some type of context. So that's a mistake. Or if you went to the other side and you could say, it makes social media effortless, or makes all your social media interactions like a dream or something. And you're almost like too high level at that point, because it's like, what does that really mean? And unless you dig down quick on that page and start explaining how it does that, then look at a few features. Like, I believe you need a nice balance of those things. You can't just go after benefits, 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 because it's just as easy to lose someone going that direction as it is to lose someone by getting out into the weeds of features too quickly.
So in your mind, what is the good mix between those two things? Is it 50-50? Is it 70-30? Are there any sorts of rules of thumb that you can come up with that kind of guide you in terms of the number of benefits or the amount of benefit you should talk about versus the features?
Yeah, the rule that I use, or kind of my loose rule of thumb, is that the headline I want it to be a promise rather than a description of the product. Sometimes you can put a description and it works. Drip, I do that with, right? It says lightweight marketing automation that doesn't suck. That's not a promise. That's actually a description of the tool. That's typically not the way I would go. There's some reasons that I've done that. But if you go to the homepage of Hittail, the headline is a promise. It says guaranteed to increase your organic search traffic. Okay, so that right there is a benefit. It's not a feature, right? So I start with that. Then I typically would want some text digging down into that of how it does that. So it still benefits. You're not talking about features yet, but you're now talking about more specific. And with Hittail's example, we unearth the keywords that you should be targeting but aren't. Then I like to start digging into a couple of features. And those are typically in some bullet points or in short snippets. And on the homepage, I believe that having maybe three features, kind of digging into those 3 to 6 features, is not a bad way to go once you've made kind of that nice promise at the top, especially if you have, I typically have some testimonials above that before I dig into features. And I also like to have some prominent press links above that of folks who've written articles about us. So I wouldn't say I have a mix, like you said, with 50-50, but that's how I think about a page in terms of first make a promise, then talk a little bit about how it's going to do it. And always keeping in mind that you're trying to use you language, right? You, the prospect, rather than me, the person who's selling something, and then slowly digging into more and more detail. So it's that inverted pyramid idea of starting fairly broad and then working down into the features. Now, that's a homepage or a landing page. Obviously, I think you should then have a full features page that digs into the nitty-gritty of what your tool does, because that's where you can go off in the weeds. And if you don't have a features page, people can have the question, really basic question of like, well, so then what does your tool actually do and how does it do it? And I think that's a benefit of having that features page that people can dig into if they have more questions.
The second reason people won't buy your product is they'll look at the website that you have and they'll just say, I don't have that problem. And this is really just a fundamental problem with the traffic sources that you have. So whether you're targeting the wrong people in AdWords or whatever paid advertising you're doing, or if you're advertising for your product on using the wrong social media or the wrong blog articles, any sorts of news outlets where it's just not applicable, or if you're trying to get from like Dig or Reddit and it's just not the right audience. There's lots of different ways to get a lot of traffic to your website, but just because you get traffic doesn't mean that it's targeted traffic. And you have to get that targeted traffic, because if the traffic is not targeted, they're probably not going to have that problem, and they're going to have absolutely no reason to not only stick around, but or to buy your product.
Yeah, targeting traffic is hard, especially if you're sending a bunch of stuff to your homepage. I mean, I think the less traffic you send to your homepage, the better. And the more traffic you send to individual landing pages that essentially look like your homepage, but that you've changed the headline to really resonate with the traffic source that's hitting it. You can't always do that, but certainly if you're running paid acquisition, if you're doing SEO, you can set up separate pages for that target certain keywords. There's a lot of ways to do this. And what's interesting is your tool probably solves a bunch of different problems, but you can't say that in a headline. And if you say the wrong one to the wrong audience, then they will wander off and have this objection of, I don't have that problem. And so the more specific you can get with your headline, and you can say, boom, do you have this problem? Do you spend way too many hours managing your social media? Or do you not have enough organic search traffic? Like a very specific thing that's targeted to those people, you're just going to stand a better chance of having them continue to read the page, which eventually hopefully leads to them to converting for you.
Yeah, and I think you can have this problem on any given page on your website. As you kind of indicated, the homepage is probably not the best place to be converting people into trials or customers, because it's too generic. You don't know the type of person who's going there. They may have just heard about your tool from somebody else, or just typed it into a search engine or something along those lines. But if they come to a specific page, especially if you've optimized that page using SEO, you can generally get a good idea of what type of person is coming to that page. So obviously there's a bit of a difference if you're using paid advertising, because then you can have a little bit more fine-grained control over it, versus if somebody writes an article about your website or your application, you don't always have as much fine-grained control over what it is that they say or how they pitch it to their audience or how they talk about your product. But if you find that those links are coming back to your site, you can certainly morph your pages to talk directly to that audience, especially if you're seeing that there's a lot of traffic coming from some of those different sources.
The third reason why people might not buy your product is that they don't trust you. I think there's a number of ways that someone could mistrust you. They could look at the site and think that it's just a little too slimy, or that it's a little too, you know, it looks like a scam, right? And I think that comes to a design problem. Your language could be over salesy, like you could be pushing too hard and they could feel like you're just trying too hard, and that would be a copywriting problem. I think aside from those, a big one is that someone might not trust that you can deliver on the promises you're making on that homepage or on that landing page. And probably the best way I know of to get around that is to use essentially lead nurturing, right? Is to offer that instead of trying to get someone to sign right up because they may not trust that you're going to deliver, or it may take too long to get set up, or whatever they're not believing that you're saying, but you offer something very small in exchange for an email address. And so you can do an email mini course educating them on how you're going to solve their problem, or on how they can solve it by themselves on their own without buying your software. Or you can give them a tools list or a PDF or a white paper or something. And then once you have their email address, you can email them a small mini course, or you can email them once a week and build that trust up. Build up the knowledge to them that you're an expert and that you can solve this problem, that you have done it. You can send them case studies. You can send them your credentials. You can send them quotes and testimonials and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you just have so much more time to do that if you have the email address than if you try to pitch everything on a web page while someone is skimming through that in between their lunch hour and their 1 o'clock meeting.
I think in addition to some of the things that you talked about, the lead nurturing thing, I think historically has been overly simplified. I think in the past, if you looked even 5 years ago or so, if you looked at the basic sales funnel for any given product on the internet, it was somebody comes to your website, they sign up for a trial, and then they purchase the product or they don't. And the overly simplified piece of it was that lead nurturing thing that you talked about, where they come to your website and you just met them. They don't know anything about you yet. Yet you're trying to sell them on a product that, and they just don't have that trust yet. And I think that that's, you talked about it pretty in depth, but I think that that's the piece that a lot of people miss when they're trying to set up their website. They're skipping over that piece and they're not thinking about what it is that I can offer people that will help establish that trust before we even get to the point where I'm asking them to sign up for a trial. And like I said, that's just something that I think people have kind of glossed over. I'd say it happens a lot less now than it did 3 or 4 years ago, but starting to come to the forefront of like, this is an important piece. And I think the hard part about that is just the length of time that it takes to go from, this is a new lead and I'm nurturing that lead, but it's hard to tell how long that lead nurturing is going to take. Sometimes it can take a day, sometimes it can take 6 months, and sometimes it can take a year. And that nebulous piece of it, the time frame for that, is what makes it so difficult for people.
Our fourth reason of why people won't buy your product is that they're happy enough with what they currently have. And this is a tough one to get around. I think it's pretty common that there's going to be an incumbent in pretty much every market that you enter into. And frankly, most people don't enjoy change. And they're not going to go out of their way, even if they can get some type of incremental benefit, they're not going to go out of their way to switch to your product. And, you know, Mike, as you noted here in the outline, the biggest competitor to most bug tracking software, it's probably spreadsheets. It's probably some hacked together thing that some people have done. And if it works well enough, then why would someone change? And so to think about getting around that objection, you really have to show not just incremental value, but you have to show dramatic savings of time, dramatic savings of money, or how you can make someone a lot more money, or how you can really remove the pain from their life. And I think that's a big thing is, you know, we talk about this, the B2B pain point thing, right? You really have to figure out exactly what that pain is, and you have to go after it, and you have to truly understand what the pain is, why they're feeling it, and you have to talk about that on your homepage and in your marketing and in your copy. And if you're kind of vague around that, and you feel like you're kind of solving a problem for a certain group of people, that's not good enough. You have to be a lot more specific about it in order to maximize folks trying out your app or becoming customers of you. You really need to understand that pain.
And number four is closely related to number five, which is that it's too hard to switch from what I'm doing today. And if what they're doing today currently is just they're trying to sign up for a bug tracking software and all they're using is spreadsheets, one of the ways to overcome that is to have a mechanism for uploading that spreadsheet into the software. There's technical ways to do this particular piece of it, and you can say, okay, well, I'm going to build an import mechanism for all of my competitors and have them allow them to upload a spreadsheet that will import stuff. But you're still asking them to do work in some way, shape, or form. They have to figure out what that export process is. They have to make sure the data is formatted properly and then import it into your system. The other way to go about this is to offer some sort of a concierge onboarding service where you offer to either for free or as a paid service, import their data in some way, shape, or form. And I distinctly remember Patrick McKenzie talking about this for Appointment Reminder, where he offered a free data import regardless of what type of system you were currently using. And some people would send him spreadsheets, some people would send him PDF files, and he would just take that data and import it into Appointment Reminder. And sometimes he literally had to sit there and copy paste things. Sometimes he had to type things in. But at the end of the day, what he was doing was he was removing the pain of switching from whatever their current system was to using his software. And I think that that pain of switching is very underrated. I mean, most people heavily discount how much effort and mental overhead there is to getting rid of that, because signing up for a new service, you're basically asking somebody to do work. And that's not what they signed up for. They signed up to get rid of some of the work that they have to do and some of the pain points that they have. And by forcing them to do this stuff manually, it is just a barrier for them to sign up for your service. So if you can remove that barrier in any way, shape, or form, then it's going to get you to do it. My wife's evaluating some different options right now because she has one. And the problem that she has is, oh, I'm going to have to take all my existing appointments and everything else, and I'm going to have to move them into this new software. And I don't want to have to do that. So it's definitely a real thing that people have to deal with. And they do take it into consideration.
Yeah. In launching Drip, Derek and I sat down and said, what are people's biggest switching costs and how can we get around those? And a concierge service is one way, just doing it for them. Building importers is another way. Even helping prepare people, like creating internal marketing docs. So there are, let's say it's a doc that allows a developer to sell the product, to convince his boss that they should be able to use this, like something your future customer can use to convince their higher ups. I've seen all of these things done and I've seen them all work, but to sit down and really give thought to how hard is it to switch? Why is it hard to switch? And what is within our power to offer folks to try to eliminate that switching cost? I think it's very powerful.
Yeah, which you kind of alluded there, and I've seen this done in the enterprise world, is they have these competitive marketing documents where they will talk about what some of the problems are that people are facing and how to overcome those challenges with a new piece of software. And some of those things are, as you said, you do it for them and you can talk about those things, but giving them the tools that they need to be able to justify internally, because they're going to ask the question, how do we go about switching and what are the pain points going to be of switching? And if you can provide them that information, it gives them ammunition to be able to say, hey, let's take this tool that isn't doing the job for us and get rid of it. And this is exactly how we're going to switch over. This is our roadmap for moving over into this new system. And if you can get that, and sometimes it takes signing up for your competitors, but at the end of the day, sometimes you have to do what you have to do.
Our sixth reason why people won't buy your product is if they can't figure out how to use it. And this is a pretty common one, right? Someone downloads a trial or they sign up for a trial and they can't figure out how to enter stuff, or they don't know what they should do, or they just kind of give up. And that typically means your product's too complicated or your onboarding isn't good enough. Okay, so if it's onboarding, that's a fixable thing. There's kind of a formula for this, right? You're going to want to send folks some emails on how to get onboarded, preferably very timely, and spelling out things they've already done and what they have left to do, and obviously having some type of walkthrough or guided setup within the app as well. If your product is just too complicated and kind of software isn't the answer, then you may need high-touch sales to explain it, right? If you've solved a complicated problem, you've built a complex solution, and you're selling into folks where the price point is worthwhile, then people aren't going to onboard into something like that when it's really hard to get set up. And that's why enterprise tools sell for so much money, right? They sell for $100,000 or $1 million, often because there's so much effort. I mean, there's effort involved in building it, but there's so much sales effort involved in getting people on board, and there's such a lag. And so I kind of think of it as one of those two things. Either your product's too complicated, in which case you need to up your game and go high touch, or you're just not onboarding well enough and you need to look at that.
Yeah, I think the misconception with some of the enterprise level products is that people look at the price and say, oh, that software is totally not worth that. And in most cases, they're right. The software isn't worth that. It shouldn't take that much effort to build the software. But what you're paying for isn't the software. You're paying for the sales effort that is required to get in front of the customers and do the work to get them set up. That's definitely something that heavily factors into the price in there. But if software becomes shelfware, then it's not providing any value. So you definitely need to be able to figure out how it is that you're going to demonstrate that value. Because if it's a SaaS product, for example, and people are signing up for a trial, if they can't figure out how to use it and they're not getting the value out of it, they're definitely not going to pay for it. You have to go through and figure out what those pain points are for them and why it is that they're not able to use the software. And maybe it is too complicated. Maybe you need to switch it to much more of a service-based offering rather than a software offering. And sometimes that's the answer. But at the end of the day, as the entrepreneur, your job is to figure those things out. It's not to build a certain type of product or a certain type of company. It's to figure out what those problems are and then fix them within the business.
And that's where the old school big ticket price enterprise sales had an advantage, because they didn't have subscribers. And when you're providing a subscription service, you have to deliver to the customer every month or they will cancel. And so if they're not using it, they're going to cancel. Whereas if you were Oracle or Siebel or PeopleSoft back in the day, or even today, I suppose, you can sell a six-figure or seven-figure deal and all the effort is up front, convincing them to buy it. And then you don't have to follow through and actually provide that much value. Now, obviously that sucks. I mean, but I've seen it happen. I've been at large enterprises where there's been this great sales job and then folks don't follow through, but the value was kind of provided all up front, and so was most of the money, aside from kind of the annual maintenance 20% that is typical.
The seventh reason why somebody might not buy your product is that they forgot about you. They came to your website, they looked around a little bit, and then somebody walked into their office and they got busy and they closed down their laptop and walked away, or closed their browser and went to do other work that came up. And they just didn't sign up for anything. They didn't download anything. So by the time they get back to their desk and they decide that they've got a free minute, at that point, they've forgotten what it was that they came to your website for to begin with. So in cases like that, you need to use something like retargeting to help bring them back. If you were lucky enough to get their email address because they did sign up for something, then you need to actually go through the process of emailing them on a regular basis. And I've done this in the past where I've collected email addresses and then just not emailed people for like 2 or 3 months. And that's the worst thing you can possibly do, because they were interested at one point, but 2 or 3 months down the road, unless you are getting in front of them and talking to them, chances are good that they either forgot about you, or the problem was just not high enough on their list of priorities to come back to you, or they found something else to solve the problem and you weren't it because you weren't talking to them. So making sure that you're going back and getting in front of those people and getting either a yes or a no, is that's essentially your job. It's not your job to kind of self-select and say, oh, well, this person didn't email us or sign up for a trial, so I'm not going to bother them anymore. And that's absolutely wrong. That's the wrong approach to take. You need to get through to them and you need to talk to them until they either say yes or go away. The eighth reason why somebody might not buy your product is that they've tried similar things before and those things didn't work for them. And I've done this myself where I've signed up for a product and it didn't work out. And then I maybe signed up for one more and that didn't work out. And suddenly I just give up on the whole genre of that particular type of product. You might have found this with something like time tracking or to-do lists. People switch those types of applications on a fairly regular basis. And at some point, I think people just get frustrated and they decide, look, none of these products work. So none of these products I've tried so far work. So none of them are going to work. And this isn't necessarily true. I mean, especially if you're taking a different approach to a particular problem. And if you're taking a different approach than other people and other competitors in your space, what you need to do is educate people about why your approach is different. Maybe the competitors that you're looking at are doing it wrong. Maybe they're not telling the story about how they went and decided to create this product because they were having that particular problem and nobody else was solving it for them. And they show people that their process needs to be molded to fit into this software. And sometimes that's just the case. The vendors will create a product based on their own internal ideas of how a particular process should work, and they don't educate their customers as they come on board about how they can modify their own internal processes to be more efficient and to get more things done. And then when the customer is trying out the software, because those things, there's a mismatch between what the customer's process is and what the vendor's process is, those things don't mix, so they don't work. And eventually the customer gets frustrated and they say, look, I'm done with this. And then they do the same thing with the next product. And then eventually they just kind of check out of the whole thing. You can use education marketing to help correct this, but sometimes it's also a problem with the problem solution fit. Maybe you're not solving the right problem. Maybe the customers have a slightly different problem. And that takes customer development. You have to talk to people who've signed up, people who just canceled, and verify that you actually do have that problem solution fit, because sometimes your promises don't match what the customer expectations are, and you need to know that earlier and sooner rather than later.
I tend to think about this in two ways. If you're in kind of a new space or new market, then the odds of them, of your customers having tried so many things that they're tired of it, are pretty low. And so I wouldn't typically use this as a factor unless you're hearing this from people who are canceling. My guess is you won't be. But if you're in a mature market where there are a lot of tools, or it's been around for 10, 15, 20 years, then there probably are going to be some older tools, some incumbents that are higher priced, that are hard to use, that are cumbersome. It's kind of the same story we see with QuickBooks or Quicken in accounting space, and the big marketing automation tools or old email marketing software. I mean, you really see as tools get older, they just get cumbersome. In that case, it's probably a good bet that people have, in fact, tried other tools and really don't like them, right? And we've used this term of refugee from X product, an Infusionsoft refugee or a QuickBooks refugee, right? It's someone who is trying to flee that product because they don't like it so much that they're willing to use kind of anything else. And in that case, that's actually a really interesting marketing angle. It's a really interesting copywriting angle. It's an interesting touch point that you can use in an email course, in a headline, in a sales letter, on a homepage, to basically just call it out. Have you tried a bunch of other products and they haven't worked for you? Are you tired of this incumbent software that's really expensive and hasn't worked for you? And you just tackle it head on, and then you present why your software isn't that and how you're kind of a new paradigm.
And the ninth reason why somebody might not buy your product is that they look at it and they say it's too expensive. And in these cases, I think that if somebody looks at the product and says that it's too expensive, it tends to be an objection, but it is coming from some other place. Either they're not seeing the value in it, or there are features that they're specifically looking for that are in a pricing tier that they're not comfortable paying for that pricing tier because they're, maybe it's a one-person shop and the specific feature that they want is in the $100 tier versus the $25 tier. There's a lot of different reasons why they may not be able to see the value. They may also not even believe that the value is there. And that might be an education problem. But it's rarely the case that if you're offering a product and somebody looks at it and just says out of hand that that's too expensive, my guess is that there is something else at play. It's not necessarily that it's too expensive. It's more that either they don't see the value or they're not looking at the right things. And it's up to you to kind of correct what it is that they're looking at or educate them. I just don't think that in most cases, unless your product is completely outrageously priced in comparison to all the competitors out there, it's hard to overprice something if you're not also delivering the value.
Yeah, you're always going to have some pricing objection to what you build. I don't think I've ever had a product priced even as low as you can possibly go and still not had someone tell you that it's overpriced. But the point at which you start to actually think that you might be overpriced is when 50% of your people are canceling because of that. You really have to hear it a lot in order to actually start thinking about lowering prices, in my opinion. The other thing is, I talked about this last MicroConf, and it was in reference to Drip, and it was in reference when we first launched. We had a bunch of people using it, and cancellations were coming through, and a number of people said very similar things. They said, this is a great tool. I love the usability. It's easy to use. But I just couldn't justify it in light of the price. And they would say that it was very similar, you know, too expensive for what it does, that kind of stuff. Now, you could look at that one way and you could say, well, we're too expensive. We need to lower our prices. Derek and I looked at it another way. I wanted to go after something called aspirational pricing, which is basically saying, I don't want to charge less than $50 a month, right? It was $49 a month price point. So how can we build enough value in this product that we are worth $49 a month? And these days, that's more how I think about it. Rather than trying to lower prices to meet expectations, how can you build enough that their expectations are met at or above your current price point?
Yeah, I think this exact topic came up in one of my mastermind group discussions, which was don't drop the price, add value to it. And I think that you can probably generically apply that advice across the board to virtually any product on the market. Don't discount the price, always add value.
So to recap, our 9 reasons why people won't buy your product. Number 1, they don't understand what you're offering. Number 2, they don't have that problem. Number 3, they don't trust you. Number 4, they're happy enough with what they currently are using. Number 5, it's too hard to switch from what they're using today. Number 6, they couldn't figure out how to use your product. Number 7, they forgot about you. Number 8, they've tried similar things before and they didn't work. And number 9, you're just too expensive. That wraps us up. If you have a question for us, call our voicemail number at 888-801-9690 or email us at questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups and visit startupsfortherestofus.com for a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening. See you next time.